It's a great pleasure, really, to introduce Jim Crace to you tonight. Oh, it's all gone dark. I feel like Mick Jagger suddenly. Both in terms of style and content, Jim Crace is a very unique writer amongst British writers. He uses allegory, which often invites comparisons with writers like J.M. Coetzee, and the way he uses landscape, invents landscape, landscapes that articulate, invites other comparisons to people like William Golding in particular. He's in all of his six novels, the themes are extremely different, the subject matter is very different, but the unity lies, I think, in his invention and the risk-taking in each book. For instance, in one of his books, he's written about Christ's 40 days in the wilderness. He's written about the Stone Age, a shipwreck in England in the 19th century. But these books are also very postmodernist. There's a kind of a real bringing together of something quite ancient and quite modern in their preoccupations. Most of all, I think, from my point of view, the language is extraordinary. It's inimitable and a subject in itself. And it's been praised by people like Frank Kermode and Malcolm Bradbury, John Updike, and many other people. The amount of prizes that Jim has won, I just cannot sort of, I haven't got time to go through them, but basically he's been shortlisted for the Booker Prize for Quarantine. He's won the Whitbread Novel Award for Quarantine. He's also won the Whitbread First Novel Prize for his first book, which was called Continent. And various prizes in Europe. He's been translated in more languages that exist in the world, I think. So it's a great honor to bring him to Warwick. That is actually not so far from his habitat in Birmingham. And I think Jim's going to read from his new book, and then we'll have a discussion and questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Russell. Yes, you're absolutely right. It has been translated into more languages than exist. When Being Dead came out, on the fly leaf of it, they put Jim Crace's books have been translated into over 20 languages. This is his third novel in Viking, which is the name of my publisher. In case you think that the life of a writer is the life of Riley, I want you to know that there are two bad moments in a writer's life, and one of them is tonight, when, after living by myself, not even showing manuscripts to my wife or my children or my editor or my agent, the time comes when a book has to be read for the first time to an audience. At a time when it's not entirely finished, when no one else has seen it or heard it other than all of you here today. And it seems to have become a tradition that torture should take place at Warwick, because I seem to remember the same thing happening when Quarantine was finished. Jeremy Tricolone seems to know when my vulnerability is at its height, and he gives me a call and says, come and read something new to us. The second monstrous moment is happily out of the way, and that's the time when the writer has to go down to his publishers, his eager publishers who are hoping for a sex and shopping novel, to explain to them what their latest book is about. That this book, for example, from my list is Arcadia, and it's about town planning and greengrocery. Or you have to tell them that this book is Quarantine and it's set 2,000 years ago in the Judean desert. And as you, in a very keen and pink fashion, describe the novel to them and look around the ranks of publicists and editors and publishers in the room, there comes a point at the end of that sentence in which you've said what the book is about, that you discover that no one is looking you in the eye. That there are faxes that suddenly have to be sent, that there are handbags that have to suddenly be delved into, and that there are fingernails that have to be studied in great detail. People always, when I describe my books, feel as if I've given them a burden that no publishing house is up to handling. However, on this occasion, when I went down to my publishers and there they were sitting around wondering what I was going to dish up for them next, and I was explaining to them that even though in the past I'd always relished the fact that books have lives of their own, and books' difficulties are self-generated, you know, in the way that I think a lot of people tend to think and want to believe, and biographers believe this, and certainly English departments and universities want to believe it, that what is very interesting about novels is the way in which they are the mirror image of the novelist. So in other words, that if you find a book about adultery, then you will find an adulterer behind the pen. And if you find a novel that's set in Birmingham University, then you will find David Lodge behind the pen. And that, of course, that is interesting. To some extent, books are mirror images of the writers. But what's always interested me is the way in which books are unlike their writers, the way in which books abandon the writer if the book is going well, and they become their own thing. And they knew very well this was my view and that I looked for books to abandon me and to surprise me as well as to horrify them. But I also had been feeling, I said to them, that the last two books I've written, Quarantine, which was about religion and God and sin, and Being Dead, which was about death, had abandoned me very early on in the writing and become their own things, as it were. But they hadn't sort of given me much emotional space. And in fact, both of those books had been immensely hard and uncompromising and unforgiving companions for the 5 years that it took me to write them. And they were nodding sagely at this. And I said, therefore, I thought that what I want to do is to write a book which is entirely light-hearted, a book which is playful, a book which is enigmatic and puckish. So already they weren't looking too terrified. But the moment of joy when at last I made eye contact with my publishers was when I said, and this is going to be a book about food. And they looked so relaxed, their legs swung open, they looked me in the eye, a couple of publicists jumped to their feet and one said, we'll have to have a lunch to launch this book. And another publisher said, we'll have a whole series of lunches. And a third said, what we'll do is we'll take some of the food in the book and get a cook to cook it and launch the book that way. I have to warn you that if any of you are invited to one of those original lunches, you should avoid going at all cost. Because my publishers, it seems, as well as a lot of critics, find it difficult to believe that fiction is full of things that are made up and can't exist and shouldn't exist and won't exist. When my book Quarantine came out, I'd invented a means of catching a game bird in the desert to be put in the pot and to be cooked. And I'd invented this for this book. And a reviewer for the London Review of Books, I won't mention who he is, but a leading literary figure and an Arabist, wrote, the misleading case of Badu hunting techniques is also instructive of Crace's technique. These are wonderfully elaborate. In order to catch a bird in the desert, you must first find a tethered goat and then rub salt in its ear in order to extract a blood-filled tick, and then tie a thread round the tick's abdomen. Leave the tick with its thread weighted down on an exposed rock and wait for a bird to swallow the proffered bait. Then, just as the bird has finished swallowing the tick, jerk on the thread to bring the bird low. Once the bird is in hand, it is a good idea to break one of its wings in order to prevent it flying away. I have spent time in the Sahara and in the empty quarter of the Arabian Peninsula, and for that matter, wandered around Judea, but I have never heard of these ingenious procedures. Forays through the pages of Violet Dixon's The Arab of the Desert, Jibrail Jabur's The Bedouins in the Desert, and K.E.M. Melville's Stay Alive in the Desert fail to shed light on these matters. I am left to fear that the author has simply made them up. So, to start tonight and to make more real the lie from Quarantine, I'm going to start off with a section of this book about food, which is a novel which is, I suppose, either very, very traditional, as I would think, it's not even a novel, a work of fiction which is either very, very traditional or very postmodern. It's a book in 70 parts. And what it attempts to do is to see if it is possible to define a culture and describe people's sense of body and sense of self and sense of the way in which they relate to their surroundings by telling 70 magic realist stories about food, which after all, after sex and death, and I've done those two in religion, is one way in which we certainly define ourselves. So these are some short pieces, and I'm going to read you just a few of these very short pieces tonight. No need to starve. When we were big enough, our parents let us wander in the hills behind the village. We knew the taste of everything, the salty gypsum in the rocks, the peachy flavours in the leaves of morning star, the sulphur of a pigeon's egg, boiled in the furnace of the sand. We knew where water was. Sometimes we begged my uncle for some matches and some cigarettes to catch scrub fowls. Smoke is better than a catapult, we said. We told him how we'd sit underneath the bushes in the riverbed and wait for a donkey or a sheep to come down for the leaves. A goat would do. We'd have to blow smoke from his cigarettes into its ears and wait for ticks to show themselves in the folds of skin. The grey or blackish ticks weren't any good. We needed one which was red-brown, bloated with sheep or donkey blood. We couldn't grip the tick and twist its jaws free of the skin without its body popping on our fingertips. But with luck, with one more cigarette, smoke might make it drop free of the ear. We'd have to catch the tick before it hit the ground, or it would burst. Then it was simple. All we had to do was pull a length of cotton from the bottom of our shirts, lasso the tick, and put it on a stone out in the sun, then tie the free end of the cotton to a branch. We'd find a cool place underneath the bush. We wouldn't have to wait, we wouldn't have to count to 10 before a scrub fowl came. It loved the blood bean of a tick. The captive tick, the cotton line, went down its throat in one. We'd snared our meal. We must be patient, we told our uncle. It can take an hour just to catch the tick. But then it only takes 5 minutes more to trap the bird, and 5 minutes in the fire to roast it. That must be hard, he said, to catch a donkey or a sheep and then persuade it to stay still while hot smoke tunnels in its ear. We shrugged, we laughed, we begged my uncle for his matches and his cigarettes. It's true, we did sit down below the bushes in the river, but we did not care for dining out on scrub fowl. We did not hunt for ticks or look for sheep and donkeys. We smoked my uncle's cigarettes, one at a time, passing them between us so that the smoke was never idle. Smoke is better than a catapult, we said. We filled our mouths and stomachs up with smoke. We fed on cigarettes. We loved the peach and salt and sulphur in the nicotine, the ashy meat and wood. We waited while our appetites fell free and hit the stony ground and burst. So now you've caught your shrub fowl. And here's a recipe that Penguin are no doubt going to offer to you as they tour the country with my book, which if I were you, I would avoid. It's said that cheese is milk that's grown up, fresh milk transformed by time. If so, then what is Boise tart? A senile dish turned bitter by the years. It's made from old blue cheese, matured, ignored enough to be as hard and slippery as a horse's hoof. The cheese is difficult, too gnarled to cut easily. You can only chisel and pare it into hard slivers, the devil's nail clippings. It won't be edible until you've baked it with sultanas, prunes, and well-hung game, a scrub fowl's best, in a sourdough case. Old cheese, old fruit, old yeast, old meat, all carcasses for New Year's Eve, the last meal of the dying year. If you've an orange that's gone hard and turned to parchment, then squeeze what resty juice remains onto the tart. Then dine the old year out with timid forks with ancient friends. This is the taste of those dishonored resolutions that have left their pungent marks throughout the house, those perfidies that have the gift of aging cheese and souring yeast and shriveling the plums and grapes and putrefying meat. Tomorrow is another year, fresh milk. This one's a sentimental one, just to show that I can do that. This is for the angel, Grandma used to say, tearing off a strip of dough for me to take into the yard. Leave it somewhere he can see. Sometimes I left the strip on the street wall. Sometimes I draped it on the washing line. Sometimes I put it on the outside windowsill and hid behind the kitchen curtain beads to spot the angel in the yard. Grandma said I wouldn't catch him eating the dough. That's only greedy birds, she explained. The angel comes to kiss it, that's all. Otherwise my bread won't rise. And sure enough, I often saw the birds come down to peck at our strip of dough. And sure enough, my grandma's bread would nearly always rise. When it didn't, she would say the birds had eaten the strip of dough before the angel had had a chance to prove it with his kisses. But I never saw an angel on the windowsill, not even once. The thought of angels in the yard terrified my girls. And so when we made bread in that same house, but 30 years along the line, and Grandma long since gone to kiss the angels herself, I used to say, to make good bread, I need an angel in the kitchen. Who will be the angel today and kiss the dough? My girls would race to kiss the dough. I'll not forget the smudge of flour on their lips, or how, when I took the scarred and toppling loaves of bread out of the oven, they'd demand a strip of hot crust to dip into the honey pot or wipe around the corners of the pate jar. This was their angel pay. This was their reward for kissing. Now, there are no angels in the kitchen. I'm the grandma, and the girls are living too far away to visit me more than once or twice a year. I'm too stiff and out of sorts to visit them myself, unless I'm taken in a car, but I don't like to ask. I stay in touch with everyone by phone. I keep as busy as I can. I clean, although the house is far too large for me. I walk when it is warm and dry down to the port and to the shops and take the taxi back. I keep plants in the yard in pots and on the windowsills. I mostly eat out of a can or frozen meals or packet soups. This afternoon I thought I'd fill my time by making bread. My old wrists ache with tugging at the dough of what I think will have to be my final loaves. I tore a strip off for good luck, kissed it, put it on the windowsill. I warmed the oven, greased the tins, and put the dough to cook on the highest shelf. Now I'm waiting at the window with a smudge of flour on my lips and with the smell of baking bread rising through the house for the yard to fill and darken with the shadows and the wings. How are we doing for time? A couple more. Short one. Spitting in the omelette is a fine revenge. Or overloading it with pepper. But take care not to masturbate into the mix, as someone in the next village did 60 years ago. The eggs got pregnant. When he heated them, they grew and grew, becoming quick and lumpy, until they could outwit him and all his hungry guests waiting with beer and bread out in the yard, by leaping from the pan with their half wings and running down the lane like boys. There is no greater pleasure than to be expected at a meal and not arrive. Whilst the first guests were standing in the villa's lobby with their wet hair and their dry wine, their early efforts at a conversation saved and threatened by fresh arrivals at the door, he was driving slowly in the rain along the coastal highway, enjoying his loud absence from the room, enjoying first the cranes and depots of the port, and then the latest condominiums, the half-glimpsed bypassed villages with their dead roads, the banks of coastal gravel, the wind, the darkness, and the trees. While they were being seated at the dining table and thinking, those who knew him, Louis is always late. He was taking pleasure from the water on the tarmac, the old film romance of the windscreen wipers and the dashboard lights, the prospect of the speedy, starless, hungry night ahead. At what point would they, his sister or her husband, George, dial his home discreetly from another room to only get the answer phone and leave the message, what? Was he okay? Had he forgotten that they'd asked him round to eat with friends? Would he come late? Was he aware of the trouble that he'd put them to? Would he arrive in time to charm the sweet young teacher that they'd found and placed at his left elbow? At what point would his plate, his napkin, and his cutlery be gathered up, and two women asked to shift their chairs along to fill his place and break the gendered pattern of the room? At what point would his hostess say, it's not like him at all? While they were eating in his absence a sweet corn soup, a choice of paddock lamb or vegetarian risotto, Mother Flimsy's tart with brandy, he was driving with one hand and with the other breaking pieces off his chocolate bar. He was dreaming repartee and dreaming manners of a king and being far the smartest, sharpest person in the room. While they were sitting in his sister's long saloon for coffee and a little nip of boulevard liqueur and getting cross about some small remark their host had made at their expense, Louis reached the 100-kilometer mark that he had set himself. He took the exit from the highway, slowed down to drive the narrow underpass, 60 sobering meters of bright lights, dry road, wind-corralled litter, a couple sheltering, and turned onto the opposing lane. He headed back towards the town and home, another 100K, 100K less cinematic, less romantic, and more futile than the journey out. The rain, now coming from the right, presented unexpected angles for the car. It tilted at the windscreen with more percussion than before. He had to put his wipers on their fastest setting. The smell was weather, chocolate, gasoline. The skyline warmed and lifted with its fast advancing lights. Those attic rooms, those bars, those streets, those television sets, those sweeping cars and cabs, those marriages which brighten up the night. His eyes were sore and tired. His mouth was dry. He'd have to concentrate to take his pleasure from the drive, his safe and happy absence from the room, his prudent, timid, well-earned thirst. He put a steady glass up to his lips and sipped. He dipped his spoon into the sweet corn soup. He chose the lamb. He nodded at the windscreen wipers for a second helping of the tart. How witty he could be, how certain in his views, how helpful with the wine, how neat and promising. The pretty woman on his left extended her slim arm and squeezed his hand by way of thanks for his good company and slipped out of the room into his car, a passenger, an absentee, the gender pattern of the room restored. He broke his chocolate bar in half and shared with her the unfed midnight journey into town. Two very short ones. Okay, to finish. Eggs, thank heavens, are still plentiful and cheap. We buy them sanctioned with the guarantee, printed on their cartons, that these eggs have been produced by hens that are protected from extremes of heat and cold, free from hunger and thirst, free from pain, injury and disease, free from fear and distress, free from discomfort, free to express themselves. In these hard times, in these slow months between the winter and the rain, we are reduced to sharing eggs, a three-egg omelette for the six of us, fried eggs divided into two or three for sandwiches, a family meal of rice with grated cheese and a single egg for flavouring, or soft-boiled eggs, two children to each spoon. We have developed ways of making do. We sit at night around the single gas fire in the kitchen, our plates wiped dry with bread, discussing endlessly the greater times ahead, how our misfortunes cannot last for good. We dream of work and cash and ranging free. The day will come when there is sunshine in the yard, when all our offspring will be well. We stay at home and contemplate the life of hens. And finally, after she had caught food poisoning from the soft cheese at the cafeteria, but before any of the symptoms had appeared, she had made love to her boyfriend, and then to an old acquaintance she'd encountered entirely by chance, and then had kissed, though only playfully but using tongues, her special friend in her local bar, a homosexual man, in fact. She fell ill that evening, fever, headache, vomiting, and the three men caught up with her early next day, fevers, headache, vomiting throughout the town. Now, she wondered, could it be that in a world where there were evidently at least three cases of sexually transmitted West and a third, he put Eddie Glove a step to his cause, a single case of gastronomically transmitted herpes. Could that old devil lurking in the bedroom flourish in the kitchen too? Might she discover recipes to feed and satisfy and aggravate those famished lovers at her door?
Next weekend, I've got to go to Abergavenny Food Festival. There's this literary event going on where Peter Blagved, myself, and Harry Matthews have to do a literary event, and I've got to read about feeding fictional characters. Peter's going to talk about his obsession with milk, and Harry Matthews is going to read a list of all he's eaten in 24 months or something. You should join us, I think, with that. I don't know, it's this extraordinary thing, food and literature. I wanted just to ask you this thing. I was watching the South Bank show the other night, and Carlos Santana was talking about when you the mark of a great guitarist, he said, someone like B.B. King or Eric Clapton or Jimi Hendrix, is the way you can hear their personalities in the fretwork. And I often feel when I'm reading your work that there's a voice there that is inimitable, that is basically unmistakably yours. You can pick up your book halfway through and you think this is a Crace sentence. I mean, where does this voice come from? If it's the right thing to call, I mean, voice is connected to character, to subject, to theme, but but there's something about the sentences that you write that are, to me, you know, one of the finest reading experiences of your work. Where does it actually come from?
Yeah, I mean, there is a difference between voice and personality. I mean, I don't actually think that such personality that I have is on show in my work. I think a lot of writers, particularly those that want to hold a mirror up to a real world, probably do reveal a good deal of themselves in what they write. But I'm naturally a secretive person. And I think that writing fiction is almost a way of validating my secrecy. And that if I start to see my own beliefs and my own personality poking its head above the balustrade, I quickly push it down. Mm-hmm. Which is why earlier I talked about the business of a novel abandoning you. And I guess that I talk about that all the time because I want to be abandoned. I want me to be absent from a book. So I think you'd be very hard-pressed to get a sense of the kind of person I am, except in the very broadest terms, from reading my books. Mm-hmm. I mean, for example, another sentence. I am a dyed-in-the-wool, North Korean-style atheist. But I think if you were to read Quarantine, you would find that it was a very scriptural book. And in fact, I can tell from the letters I get, mostly from America, and with one exception, that religious readers find that the book underscores their religion rather than undermines it. So that's something that's happened despite me. So I think maybe something's coming through, but it's certainly not my beliefs and not my personality.
Mm. Well, Quarantine was a challenge, if you like. I mean, sorry, Christ's 40 Days in the Wilderness was a challenge. And Quarantine is a kind of challenge of that story. Mm. For one thing, you question, it starts off with an epigram, it's a medical epigram, which kind of implies that 30 days is the maximum amount of time that anyone could survive without food, and therefore 40 days is almost stretching it too far. So the implication that Christ dies in the book.
I have to interrupt you there and say that actually, the maximum amount you can live, you can fast without food and drink, the total fast, is about 6 days.
Yes.
And you don't have to go to the desert to do that. If you were to sit inside Sainsbury's and not have food and drink, you'd not only be killed by the music, but you die in 6 days. It'd be the same. But when I was writing the book, I 6 days wasn't enough for my book. Mm. I needed longer. And as I always invent epigraphs for the beginning of my books, I just invented an epigraph from a fake...
This is the one.
From a fake work of medical expertise, which said, an ordinary man of average weight and fitness, embarking on a total fast, that is a fast during which he refuses both his food and drink, could not expect to live for more than 30 days, nor to be conscious for more than 25. For him, the 40 days of fasting described in religious texts would not be achievable, except with divine help, of course. History, however, does not record an intervention of that kind, and medicine opposes it. And you can read that in The Limits of Mortality by Ellis Winwood and Professor Michael Sewell. It's published by Echo Press in New Jersey, 1993, and I believe a single copy is worth a countless amount of money. The epigram, I should say, at the beginning of...
Well, I fell for that, I must admit.
Well, yes, well, a lot of critics always do. The epigram at the beginning of The Devil's Larder, for those Bible students here, you'll recognise it, is from... From Visitations, book 7, verse 11. So if you want to check up on Visitations when you get home. And the quote is, there are no bitter fruits in heaven, nor is there honey in the devil's larder. And so that's the spurious, invented place that the title for The Devil's Larder comes from.
But yeah. As an atheist, when you were writing Quarantine, before it was published, were you worried about the reception was going to get? I mean, it's a book about Christ's 40 days in the wilderness, but it's. I should say, for those of you who've not read it, you know, it's actually the main character is a character called Musa, who's in a sense the devil that Christ almost casually raises from his deathbed, and therefore creates his own bad luck. And so he's the storyteller of the book in a sense. But at the heart of it's a re-examining of a religious doctrine or a religious story. And I just wondered if you're worried about.
Well, my wife was worried. My daughter, I think, was a bit worried. I think my publisher was marginally worried. My neighbours was... You know, I noticed that the houses around us were emptying when I was writing it. But what I realised was that even though I'm actually sort of a very cowardly person, I wouldn't have wanted to have been fatwad, and I think that I would probably favour my own safety against the integrity of any of the books I write. Nevertheless... When I was writing, I wasn't at all nervous, and it became clear to me that it helped me understand what had happened to Salman Rushdie. When the Satanic Verses came out, a lot of people who knew about the Islamic world, the Muslim world, and certainly Rushdie would have done because he was born into a Muslim family, said, how could he make this mistake? He knew the history of fatwas. He knew that you couldn't take the prophet's name and the prophet's wife's name in vain. He must have known what he was doing. He brought it on himself. What I realised when I was writing this book was that when you're writing it, you're in so much in a book's thrall that and so frightened of the book and so fearful that you won't be able to complete it and get it right, that the idea that it's going to be read by somebody far away enough to upset them is an impossible thought. In fact, you don't even believe that it's going to be finished or published or that you can manage to write the next chapter. You have no sense of the book beyond the little cocoon that you're in at that moment. And so when I was writing this book, instead of being fearful, I think that I just felt whenever the book needed to be aggressive and to take risks, that that's what the book was demanding. And so I did it. I mean, as it happens, the book has not caused any offence at all, except, as I say, to this one man in Columbus, Ohio, who sends me a letter on the first of every month telling me that his visit to England is getting closer.
This is like an act of love, almost.
Yes.
But the quarantine, and I'm also looking for a through theme in your work, and I to call you a moral writer needs perhaps some sort of expansion, but quarantine is about the effects of change, if you like. It's about spiritual journeys in the same way that Gift of Stones is as well. I mean, Gift of Stones is about a community of stone cutters on the advent of the discovery of bronze, and their community, their way of life, their life, their jobs are gone. So that change is brought about through something organic. The changes that go on in quarantine is spiritual journey. But change seems to be a theme of yours, that the effect of it, And I don't know whether you think it's good or bad or both, or just it's something that is just inevitable, but it's always in the work, the effect of change on communities.
There's a wonderful ambiguity about change, because there was, I forget who said this, I think it was Jung. I've never read any Jung, so I've only read it in a book of quotations. But it was the cost of anything new worth having, the price of anything new worth having, is the loss of something else worth keeping. So it's that tension between trading in something you've loved for something that you want that goes on, I think, in communities and goes on in personal lives. Mm. And my books always tend to inhabit that area, I think.
Yeah.
But you don't think it out. It's not so, I don't know what it's... It's a lot of... There are writers I know that plan their books like military campaigns. And you can go into their offices before they start writing, and it's all up in flowcharts, and they know what's happening and where it's happening, and it's planned. I remember once listening to Ian McEwan talking about on Woman's Hour, because if you're a writer, you can listen to Woman's Hour every day, talking about his book, A Child in Time, before he'd written it. And I remember thinking, what a fabulous book this will be if he can pull it off. And he described the way that it worked and what the thesis of the book was, and lo and behold, the novel came out, this wonderful novel. I recommend it. And lo and behold, he had produced the book he described before he wrote it. Well, I'm not one of those writers. I don't know what the book is until it starts to present itself. Mm. And then I kind of field it and play it as the mood takes me. But I think really, rather than planning things and sort of having a great literary theory, because I'm not a great book lover or literary theorist, I think really what I'm trying to do is to amuse myself. Mm. So this is why I don't write about myself, because I'm not interesting to me. What I want to write about is the things that I'm interested in, that engage me. And the reason that I want to do that is because it's a long day. You know this. It's a long day. Mm. You've walked the dog. The children are at school. Your wife's not coming home until five. And then anyway, she's bored with what you do. The neighbours don't know what you do. No one's calling. Certainly the editor never calls. You never hear from your publisher, do you? And so what you want to do is to take a track which gives you the most entertainment, to take as many risks as you want, to invent as many things as you can, mm. in order to make yourself amused or threatened or chuckled or whatever mm. it is.
Well, that's a very good description of the act of writing, really. It is self-contained. And I concur with Baudelaire's remark sometimes that he has this disgust with the reality. You know, the reality is a place that you want to get away from, and the world of the book is the utopia, in a sense.
I want to get away from both, to tell you the truth. I'm never happier than when I'm not writing. In that period between the book being delivered and being published is a wonderful time. But the writing life, I remember when my daughter was about four and she just started to do joined-up writing. And she, like me, is very keen, always has been, on stationery. And for Christmas, she bought me one of those packs of 2 inches by 2 inches notepad things, you know, that are different colours all the way down. There's about 500 of them. And she very proudly gave me that on Christmas Day and stuck it on my desk with a pen on top of it, making sure I used it. And on Boxing Day, she went in and she wrote on the top one in her spindly little handwriting, "No messages." And on December the 27th, she went in and she turned the next one over and she wrote on the next page, "No messages." And I still have this, which I think, like, and it's 365 pieces of paper which say "no messages" and then "Milkman." And I think it should be given to a museum of writing as the real true image of the writing day. No drugs, no alcohol, no women, just no messages.
Well, one thing that I wanted to talk about, which wasn't so much apparent in what you've read, is the use of landscape in your work. That you've always managed to create an emotional correspondence between your characters and the landscape. And so, therefore, the landscape is often described as fractious or sort of, troubled. You transfer human qualities onto landscapes. And
yes, so the landscapes like characters in the book or dislike other characters. Yeah.
And, of course, you know, I've been teaching today, funnily enough, and I've been sort of saying to students, if you want to show character emotion, the landscape or the setting is there for you to use to reveal your characters. But also, landscapes, it works the other way around, too, you know. The landscapes, as you say, have a kind of human quality. I think your landscapes are actually quite moral, if you know what I mean. I read your stones, I read your landscapes to get a clue about how characters feel.
Well, if you don't believe in God, and I don't, that doesn't mean that you don't have a sense of wonder and awe at at the physical universe, the natural world. In fact, if you don't believe in God, I would suggest that your sense of awe at the natural world is even greater than those people that do, because the narratives of science, the way that the natural world is explained, are much more fascinating than what I consider to be the rather childish narratives of the Bible. And the natural world, therefore, is the narrative and the place where you are going to find moral messages, which is why, exactly as you say, it's almost as if I give to landscape the role that believers would give to a God. The feeling that transcendence and spirituality and such words which only belong to religions, they don't seem to belong to atheists, can be found in natural things and not in supernatural things, yeah, for those of us that don't believe in God.
That's very good. You can clear up an issue for me. Have you ever said this, that the writer ought to describe the coffin, not the grief?
Yeah.
You did.
Where did you get that from?
I don't know, but I was, that's why I couldn't kind of. But it was down in some notes that I had.
I'll tell you what it is.
What does that mean? What do you mean by that?
Oh, God knows. No, I do know what I mean, because I remember. This also sounds rather fancy, but it's also from a book of quotations. I haven't read anything, just a book of quotations. And there was a Chinese poet in about the 4th century who said that the writer, the poet, should be reticent with the emotion. And specific about the thing. Reticent with the emotion and specific about the thing. Therefore, it's no use saying, oh, my heart is broken, my wife is dead, because we don't believe you, we didn't know your wife, why should we take your word for it? But if you describe the discarded clothes of the wife and describe the physical things, then somehow or other you are much more able to express the emotion. And therefore, that's where that quote that you said comes in, that you should describe the coffin and not the grief. Because that, as far as it's not a golden rule, but as far as I'm concerned, it's a policy that I follow.
Yes.
I mean, you see it in pop music. I was only listening just the other day to someone who gave me an old tape with a Joni Mitchell song on it. And it was about a man leaving a relationship. And the woman is not going to win the Nobel Prize, this line, but she said that the morning after he'd gone, the frying pan was too large. And it's a simple image, but it's a good one, because the frying pan that had two eggs in it has now only got one egg in it, and this represents the breakup of the marriage and the relationship in a way much more graphically and readily than she would than if she described how upset she was, which would have taken pages and wouldn't have been convincing.
Yeah, it's an economy as well. Kind of language. I'm going to turn this over to you in a second for asking a question, but you know, many people here are students of fiction, really, and they might be interested in knowing how your first book was conceived. The book is called Continent, and it's you tell me if I'm, you know, correct me here, because I haven't read it for several years, but it's, you know, it's, it refers to the seventh continent, really, a kind of fictitious place, vaguely third world, and there are seven stories in the book. So whether it's a novel or whether it's seven stories is immaterial to me. It's a book of fiction. The seven stories are interconnected by style, but also by kind of landscape. Again, it's an invented landscape. It's vaguely third world. It could be Africa. It could be the Middle East, but it doesn't matter. It really isn't the point, as you said earlier, you know, that critics are always trying to tick off your work according to the facts of history or the facts of landscapes. And if you haven't got it right, like recipes, like, you know, some sort of act of nature, they will criticize you for it, which misses the whole point of fiction. Anyway, but this book is filled with geology, mythology, zoology, ethnography, and yet in your CV I've noticed that you spent some time in Sudan, for instance, and I just wondered, when you were writing your first book, whether you were drawing at that point on some real experience, whether it's geological or whether it's emotional, it doesn't really matter, but were you, it's a long way of asking a simple question. Where did the first book come from?
Well, I'd written a short story which Jeremy Treglown kindly gave a rave review to in the New Statesman, called Annie California Plates, which was just a 3,000-word story published in the New Review. And it sort of became, it sent out a few waves. And I was a journalist at the time, but the phone started going, and people were offering me contracts to write a novel. Or they were asking if I'd like to join their literary agency. So here I was, having written nothing, hanging out in a pub with a contract, with all my mates who'd got vanloads of poems and Tolkien-esque novels, who hadn't got anything to do with them. It was a kind of a strange inversion. So I thought I'd better write a book. And I thought, because of my political background and because of what I thought that I'd want to do, my image of myself when I was 17, I thought I'm going to have to write a leaflet book, a book that's going to change the hearts and men of human minds of men and women, a book like Steinbeck, a book like Orwell, a political book, a didactic book. And I tried to write it, and I remember writing it and thinking as I wrote each sentence, I didn't know what the next sentence was going to be. I didn't know what the ideas were. I didn't know what the next word was. And I recognised pretty soon that you cannot play the hand you haven't been dealt with. That even though I saw myself as a political human being, my artistic abilities weren't political. That's not what I could do. And then I was reviewing a novel by Gabriel García Márquez, and I read it, and it was suddenly it was a revelation. Because even though I knew it was a great novel, I didn't admire it, because I thought, I can do that. He's just telling broad, total lies about places that don't exist. And I've been doing that all my life.
Is this 100 Years of Solitude?
No, it was a book called In Evil Hour.
Oh, yeah.
It was a minor work. I was reviewing it, I can't remember who for the TLS or something. And I thought, I can do that. Just make stuff up. It doesn't have to be realistic. You don't have to hold a mirror up to real life. You can just invent. You don't have to do any research. Just make stuff up. So I sat down, and Continent, the political aspects of Continent, the whole idea of how does the third world cope with living alongside this rich northern world that we inhabit, and what changes will we wreak on each other. I just sat down and decided that I would write a book which would feed into that. And so it didn't rest on my experience in the Sudan. That had been many years before. Since then, I'd been a journalist, and I travelled in South America, I'd travelled in Asia. So really, it was just using my non-European experience rather than anything in particular. Mm. Every time I came up to a point which reminded me of a real place, I would cut it out and invent something. So rather than using real tribes, I would invent tribes. Don't use real animals, invent animals. So it just became a spree of invention.
The raison d'etre of it, you know, it's the oral tradition, it's how it started. You know, if you're interested in the ancient world, well, the ancient world literature passed around orally, and I think that's the spirit of that oral tradition is in your work, in Continent in particular.
Thank you.
Shall I pass it over to you for questions? Does anyone like to, who would like to ask the first question, which is always the tough one? Thank you.
Just because I know that you're a writer and not of novels and not a playwright, but I'd be very interested to know how you responded when you first saw Quarantine performed at Birmingham Met.
Yes. Well, I'm the kind of person that is well disposed to whatever people do, really. I don't feel jealous of my work. I don't want to defend its integrity. I don't mind who does what with it, as long as they're having fun, because I've written the book and nothing's going to change the book. First of all, there's an approach to make a film of Quarantine. And the book, the film was being written by Patrick McGrath and Mariah Aitken. And they got the film, which was fairly true to the book, too true to the book, I think, up to Sony. And Sony said, we will make this into a film if you will recast this novel about Jesus set 2,000 years ago in the Judean desert into a modern parable of survivalism in the United States. And they... They phoned up, horrified on my behalf, and telling me how they'd immediately dismissed this notion with a sneer and swept out of California. And I thought, well, I would have liked to see that. And it's with that sort of spirit that I think that I went along to see Quarantine at the Rep, expecting it to be different, wanting it to be different. I didn't get involved. They wanted me to go along to rehearsals. They didn't want to get involved in rehearsals because what can be worse than having the author sitting there saying, I didn't mean that, and I want it like this. So I kept out of the way.
And I went along, and I thought they made a really good fist of it. I had a good evening at the theatre. My kids enjoyed it. And I was very, very happy with it. But that's my way, I'm afraid. Did you see it?
Yes.
How did you feel about it?
I thought that it worked very well.
Mm.
In fact, I saw it at the moment before I read the book.
Oh, right.
And I was interested to see how closely they had tried to bring out the characters in the book. Well, I thought that inevitably some worked better than others.
Mm.
Having seen the play first and then read the book, I wish that I had read the book, seen the play, and possibly then reread the book.
And then seen the play again, I mean. Because remember, I'm on 10%. Yes. Oh, well, yeah, I think they did well. I think they did well.
Questions?
Tell us about the novel, sort of gaining a life of its own. I find this quite hard to get my head around, really, because I think that, in a way, I think at least that I'm so grounded in either the experiences of trying to handle that I've read about, or, you know, that I think other people are having, or whatever. I mean, when it takes on a life of its own, is it completely made up by our imagination? And if so, I mean, are you constantly carrying around this sort of huge imaginative thing that's going on in your head at the same time as normal life? And if that's right.
No, it's not. Everybody is. It's not just me. Everybody is to a lesser degree, a greater or a lesser degree. Human beings, this is my old hymn, I'm going to sing it again, but human beings are narrative animals. We don't have the ability to reimagine the past and reinvent the past the way that we do 9/10 of the time every day, or to tell lies about the future, or to imagine the future, or to entertain ourselves with lies and stories and jokes. We don't have that skill by chance. It is something which is there for good scientific Darwinist reasons. It confers upon us an advantage. So narrative is part of all human beings, just not writers who happen to deal with the formal version behind hard covers. And you know that's true because you know that when you're in the bar, and I've said this before, I'm sure, in this same place, when you're in the bar and the person that cannot tell stories walks in, then you don't want to have a drink with that person. You don't want to hear them tell you about their holiday in Spain and the flight number and what motorway they got. And you want to hear somebody that does what you all do, which is to take the anecdote that didn't happen to them, take the story which almost happened to them, lasso in the thing that didn't happen, the thing that did happen to them, but change it, and put them all so neatly together that they fall together with the punchline in the right place. And that's what we all do. It's a social skill. It's how we get girlfriends and boyfriends, it's how we get jobs, it's how we get people to talk to us in pubs. So narrative is a central skill, is a natural skill. And what I feel is that we all know what it feels like to have narrative running away with us, to have it having legs of its own. And it might take a drink to do it, or it might take some thick cigarettes, or it might just take the joy of the moment. But we all know, and it's all happened to us, most of us in this room, I'm sure, where sometimes we start to tell something and it really comes out wonderfully well. And I think that's what a practice writer can call up almost by command, the ability to have that mix of inspiration and skillful control. There's a terrible image I use, if I can just extend it a bit. Terrible image, you'll excuse it, but we ought to have some terrible images. And it's to do with flying a kite. And when you go up to the Licky Hills or the Clent Hills and you see a boy standing on the top of the hill flying a kite with the string going up into the sky and the kite flapping around, it's very easy to look at the boy and think that he's holding the kite up in the air, and to think that the boy on the ground is controlling the kite. And equally, it's a mistake to think that the wind, which is actually controlling the kite, is keeping the boy stuck on the ground, that one controls the other, or the boy controls the kite, or the kite controls the boy. Neither are true. You need both of them. You need the boy's skill to make it loop the loop, but you need the uncontrollable wind to make it fly at all. And I think that's really what I feel. I feel, this is a terrible image, But I also feel that what I'm trying to do when I write is to sort of get the kite aloft and to not resist the wind when it blows it in directions which I haven't expected. And we all know what that feels like, because that's a natural skill, not just a literary skill.
Any other questions?
Just something you were mentioning about your sort of happy phase of course finish. I was just wondering, at what point then must you sit down with your blank piece of paper, or are you one of these people that are constantly scribbling and making up things and snatching up things?
No, I'm not. No, I never. No. I do everything I can to avoid it. I remember once sitting next to somebody whose identity you will probably guess, who was asked what his typical working day was. You know who this is. And he said, I spend all day in a stupor of drink and drugs. And then I wake up, in the middle of the early hours of the morning, pregnant with paragraphs. And then I run downstairs and spend 4 or 5 hours staring at a blank screen until the blood starts to burst from my forehead. I remember thinking, God, you know, the best I can come up with is sort of a rash. I happen to enjoy other things more than writing. And that's really where my passions go. Except there is and I'm rather nervous of writing, and so I put it off forever. I never write at night, I never write at the weekends, I never write before everyone's out of the house, I never write after the kids have come home. I do a block during the day, every day for 5 days running when a book is underway. And I do it at my word processor in my room, and which is a converted garage into a little thin office. And it's just good old-fashioned, puritanical discipline, really, which is rather dull. But at the centre of that dullness is this sort of possession that I feel when it's going well, which makes it all worthwhile. But for 364 days out of 365, I would rather do anything other than write.
Not the message you want to hear, I'm sure. Another question?
The lady in the front.
So. I thought you'd say somewhere that after you finish quarantine, you almost become agnostic. I mean, was that a short-lived phase, and did you go back to atheism very quickly?
No, I didn't say that. No, I'm sure you're not making it up, but the journalist who wrote the article obviously was. No, you will never hear the dirty word agnostic across my lips. I am really a thorough atheist, an unforgiving, hard-nosed atheist. What I did say was that you can't spend 2 years in the presence of religions and gods and prophets and devils and sin and virtue, as I did with quarantine, without it making you reconsider your atheism, and to wonder whether the atheism, as indeed I felt that I had been living under, was too bleak an atheism. The atheism that I used to be central to me was the atheism of my father's generation, atheism which was entirely political, so that in the 1930s, if you said I don't believe in God, because the churches were controlled by the ruling classes, here's the Marxists coming out. Because the churches in those days and still controlled by the ruling classes, and because the ruling classes owned the universities and the banks and the English language and the countryside and the monarchy, well, you can fill the rest in. But to say I don't believe in God was to say I don't believe in the ruling class. But of course that was an inadequate belief for me, because it's not just believers in Christianity who want some kind of spiritualism and mysticism in their life. It's also people like myself who recognize that the world is dangerous and wonderful at the same time, and also feel that even though there is no God, we recognize that the things that make people believe in God do exist. And I think that's really the position I reached, not a position of agnosticism, but a position of sentimental atheism to replace my hard-hatted atheism that existed before.
You haven't mentioned my favorite book of yours, which is Being Dead. And you talked about risk-taking as well as invented landscapes. But certainly that is the greatest risk to take by killing off your two main characters on the opening page of the novel. How did you come to that? As well as, although you say you don't do that much research and invent the field, surely there's a lot of research that went into decomposition, etc.
It's supposed to fool you, no. I do remember that moment going along to Penguin and saying, I've written a murder story, and there was a half flicker of interest. And I said, the characters are dead on the first page and we never discover who murdered them. And immediately their old handbags were out again. It follows on from what I was saying earlier. And that is that if you are seeking to find an optimistic take on the world in the absence of gods, then clearly the optimism that is going to follow death cannot exist in the future, because there is no afterlife. We will not be living forever and a day eating yogurt and honey in the Elysian fields. We are not. We are dead, and that's it. Remember when you first heard it, and it's coming. So if I was going to find a message of optimism and hope in these 70 years, which for all of us will end, it was going to have to be found retrospectively. And so I thought that what I would then want to do, therefore, is to start a book in which the characters were at their most exposed and at their most hopeless. In other words, they were dead. They were bludgeoned to death with a piece of granite. And to see if the book could run backwards, to find in the lives lived the message of optimism that I believe is there. So that's why I started at that point and ran backwards. But as for the facts of dead bodies, if you want to, you can make up anything. And the key to making things up is vocabulary. It's not facts. You can go to parties and someone will talk to you and they'll be full of facts and you don't believe them. You're bored. But if somebody has got vocabulary, it's totally convincing. And so what you do is you don't research, you assume the vocabulary, and if the vocabulary isn't there, you invent it. And then you talk, you use that vocabulary with confidence, and that's how you tell lies in life, and that's how you tell lies in books. And so when it came to describing dead bodies, I invented it, but I also had a kind of a background. We all know, we imagine we don't know about bodies, and that's because we think that dead human beings are different from other dead things. And I just reminded myself that these dead human beings were like all the other dead things I knew intimately. The many walks I've done along the coast where I've come across a seagull dead on the edge of the sea, and I've turned it over with my toe, and I've maybe looked down, not in a ghoulish way, and I've looked down and I've looked at the flesh, decaying flesh, and the ribs grinning through the feathers, and thought this animal, this bird, has flown, and now it has dropped. There's nothing sad about it. There's something kind of triumphant about it almost. And it was that I used. It was that experience of roadkill, in a way, of the carnage in the countryside, that I used and applied to my dead bodies in the descriptions in Being Dead, even though I've only ever seen one dead body in my life, and that was just for a brief second through half-closed eyes. So power to the liars.
Yeah, providing you tell the story well, a liar is always forgiven, I think.
Yeah. I hope so.
Well, yes, that's a dodgy remark, but partly true. I think we're going to stop, but I think you have one more vignette,
yes.
Is that right?
Yes. Just a last reading to round off, page and a half. Someone has taken off and lost the label on the can. There are two glassy lines of glue with just a trace of stripped paper where the label was. The can's batch name, RG2JD19547, is embossed on one of the ends. Top or bottom end, no one can tell what's up or down. The metal isn't very old. They do not like to throw it out. It might be salmon, not cheap, or tuna steaks, or rings of syrupped pineapple, too good to waste, guava halves, lychees, leek soup, skinned Italian plum tomatoes. Of course, they ought to open up the can and have a look, and eat the contents there and then, or plan a meal around it. It must be something that they like, or used to like. It's in their larder. It had a label once. They chose it in the shop. They shake the can against their ears. They sniff at it. They compare it with the other cans inside the larder to find a match in size and shape. But still they cannot tell if it is beans or fruit or fish. They are like children with unopened birthday gifts. Will they be disappointed when they open up the can? Will it be what they want? Sometimes their humour is macabre. The contents are beyond description. Baby flesh, sliced fingers, dog waste, worms, the venom of 100 mambas. And that is why there is no label. One night, when there are guests, and all the wine has gone, they put the can into the candlelight amongst the debris of their meal and play the guessing game. An aphrodisiac, perhaps. Let's try. A plague. Should they open up and spoon it out? A tune, canned music, something never heard before that would rise from the open can, evaporate, and not be heard again. The elixir of youth, the human soup of DNA, a devil or a god. It's tempting just to stab it with a knife, wound it, see how it bleeds. What is the colour of the blood? What is its taste? We all should have a can like this. Let it rust. Let the rims turn rough and brown. Lift it up and shake it, if you want. Shake its sweetness or its bitterness. Agitate the juicy heaviness within, the gravy heaviness, the brine, the soup, the oil, the sauce, the heaviness. The choice is never touching it again or wounding it with knives. Thank you. Thank you.